When I was growing up, my whole idea of opera came from the Ed Sullivan Show. And I would turn it on to see the comedians and, you know, the guy who juggled the plates. And then every couple of weeks, Ed would have on some gigantic fat woman who would just beller, and it was horrifying to me. You know, so that my first impression of opera was indeed that impression that has been turned into a little standard phrase here in America, which is used all the time now. The opera isn't over until the fat lady sings, and there is indeed some truth in that. I mean, God has not given all of His talents in one bundle, and it's indeed true that many of those singers with the greatest voices are not visually the most appealing. I remember a broadcast of La Bohème from the Met. It was televised, absolutely magnificently sung, but the tenor, Rodolfo, who is the starving young artist living in the garret in Paris, was Pavarotti. This enormous man who clearly not only hadn't missed a meal in some months, but was having four or five extra ones in a given day. The Mimi, who was dying of consumption, was Montserrat Caballé, a magnificent Spanish soprano, but those of us who love her often would jokingly refer to her as Monster Fat Cowbelly. Just an enormous woman, huge woman. And the scene in the cafe when they go out to the Café Momus and they've just met and fallen in love and they're sitting at this little table and they're embracing each other, they could not get their arms around each other. It was a sight to behold. But the mystery and magic of opera is that by the final act, when she was dying and he was sorrowing over her death, what was coming out of their mouths was so extraordinarily beautiful that by the end, the visual had vanished and they had created that mystery. And it was a great bohème. It was one of the great bohèmes I've ever seen. And absolutely heartbreaking at the end. Opera is magical in that way. And perhaps it's more magical because what it is relying on is the most beautiful of all instruments, and that's the human voice. The human voice is quite simply the most magnificent musical instrument ever created, and when well used, it can move us unlike any other. Now, it's interesting because opera is a fairly new creation, quite honestly. I mean that in comparison to most of the other literary forms we've been looking at. Opera was born in Italy about the time Shakespeare was writing Othello in England. We don't have an exact date, but opera is a late blooming plant that comes at the end of the Italian Renaissance. And a group of Italian noblemen who called themselves the Camerata got together and decided, out of their love of the classical world, particularly classical Greece, that they wanted to attempt to revive Greek tragedy. They were going to attempt to come up with a form that would mimic what the Greeks had accomplished with the nobility of Greek tragedy. Now, they had a problem here, because while it was possible to read the texts of Greek tragedies, we do indeed know that Greek tragedies were originally, to a large degree, sung. If you go through a Greek tragedy, most of you know this, there is a group of actors who are called the chorus. And interspersed through the dialogue and through the dramatic confrontations are choruses. Those choruses, indeed, in the original, would have been sung and danced. And what you have, in fact, as you go through, you'll sometimes see the choruses in Greek tragedies. The first stanza will be called the strophe, the second stanza the antistrophe, and then the epode. That's a reference to actual choreography that went on, and the direction in which the chorus would be moving and dancing while they sang. So we could in one way say that Oedipus Rex, Agamemnon, Medea were all musicals. And I mean that in terms of our definition of musical. Dialogue interspersed with music. And it may be possible that the dialogue itself was chanted. The problem was we've lost all that music. We know about Greek modes, but we do not have Greek music written down. We don't really know what it was. We have no real sense of what kind of music would have been used for those choruses. So the camerata decided that what they wanted to do was to attempt a revival of Greek tragedy, and as far as they could determine, it meant having a sung play. That is, taking a story from classical mythology, dramatizing it, and then having it sung. I'm talking the 1580s, the 1590s, thereabout. And these became rather popular, and of course they brought in some of the best musicians in Italy of that day to set these stories to music. What happened at that time, and it is something that has followed through throughout the subsequent history of opera, is that while the words and the music are indeed joined together, there has always essentially been a battle between the two. And the question for any composer or librettist, and the libretto is simply the play that is then set. You need a poet to write out the libretto, to write the words, then the composer takes it and sets it to music. Point being, you have two different artists dealing with two different kinds of art form, poetry and music, and the big question in opera is which should predominate, the words or the music? Which one is more important? The ideal, of course, is that there should be a balance. In fact, throughout the history of opera, there has never really been a balance. One or the other tends to predominate. That means the words are viewed as primary, the music is there to support the words, so that basically we're listening to what's said and the music is helping guide us through and get the meaning, or the music predominates and what we are listening to is the music, although we indeed hear the words that are telling us the story, but you have a composer who is in charge. This has gone back and forth. In the beginning, at the dawn of opera, the words predominated. Although it did not take long until the first great masterpieces of opera were written. And what we had, it's the easiest definition of opera. Opera is simply a sung play. A play that is sung instead of spoken. That being the case, we need a musician to set the words. The first great opera composer, the first great opera, 1603. Oddly, the same year that Shakespeare's Othello was probably being premiered in London. And the man's name was Monteverdi. Very great composer. Wrote madrigals, wrote church music, particularly magnificent, if you don't know them, the Vespers of the Blessed Virgin. Extraordinary piece of music, composed for St. Mark's in Venice. Well, Monteverdi began composing operas, and the first great opera is his Orfeo. It is the tale of Orpheus. It is an opera. It is full five acts, set to music, absolutely magnificent music, and already the tension between words and music are there. But always, of course, if you get a great composer, the music starts dominating. From that point on, opera has a glorious history. And one great genius after another has directed his attention to composing operas. We have moments in time. Opera spread throughout Europe then. In every country, every land, many, many composers became extremely popular. It was an upper class entertainment. It was not like the theater in London where everyone from the Queen to the lowest rag picker in the streets went to the theater. That was not the case. Opera has always been an upper-class entertainment. It was at the beginning, and it has for the most part, except for Italy, and Germany to an extent, remained that. Many of the great composers worked in it. In the early 18th century, George Frederick Handel first made his name as an opera composer, and indeed composed dozens of magnificent operas before he turned to the oratorio. We probably know him best for The Messiah, which is basically the setting of a text that is not meant to be acted. It is simply to be sung with an orchestra. It is not acted out. It is not dramatic as such. But Handel learned about putting drama into music through being an opera composer. Through the latter part of the 18th century, the divine Mozart, as he's called, Mozart spent most of his latter years attempting to get commissions for operas. What he wanted to do above all things was to write opera. And indeed, many of us think he wrote the greatest operas ever written. The Marriage of Figaro, Don Giovanni, Così fan tutte, The Magic Flute, incomparable. Nobody touched him. And there's something a bit sad in this great genius walking around trying to find commissions, because you could not dedicate that amount of time to composing an opera, a very lengthy work, and extremely difficult to compose, if there wasn't somebody willing to pay you to do it. And Mozart had great difficulty finding commissions and thus wrote a lot of other things. His, much of the other music written because he could get commissions for a new piano concerto or a new string quintet, but difficult to get someone to commission the operas. But nevertheless, he viewed himself to a large degree as an opera composer. And the operas are simply magnificent. And one could say an almost perfect balance between words and music. He was lucky enough to find a great librettist, a man named Lorenzo De Ponte. De Ponte turning out magnificent libretti for Mozart for three of those that I mentioned, the Marriage of Figaro, Don Giovanni, and Così fan tutte. After Mozart's death, De Ponte gave up the opera stage, moved to this country and opened a grocery store in Brooklyn. I'm not joking. It's true. In fact, he's buried up there. Strange world we live in. But the real explosion of operatic genius comes with the 19th century. We have a string of great composers who dedicate their talent solely to the creation of opera. They will do a few other things, but basically, you have a string of composers who are most interested in writing opera. a long, long string of these gentlemen in Italy, beginning with Rossini, who wrote dozens of operas. Best known, of course, for The Barber of Seville. Some of you know it through The Bunny of Seville, a cartoon masterpiece. But what happened was a tradition was established via Rossini, passed on to Bellini, then to Donizetti, and finally to Verdi. Simultaneously in Germany, you have a great musician named Carl Maria von Weber. You have poor Beethoven, who tried desperately his whole life to write opera, spent 14 years working on the one opera that he finally did complete, and it is a masterpiece, but it cost him more sweat and blood than perhaps anything else he ever wrote, a magnificent opera called Fidelio. But after that one outing, he never made a second attempt. And then, of course, that giant that looms following Beethoven, Wagner, extremely modest young man who decreed himself the equal of Beethoven in music and the equal of Shakespeare in drama. It's interesting, an easy way to sort of keep things in perspective. Both Verdi and Wagner were born in the same year, 1813. Their careers span the 19th century. They are the two giants of romanticism in 19th century music. But they do very, very different things. Wagner, in one sense, is more connected with what the original Camerata wanted opera to be. And that is the setting of mythic legends on the stage. Taking myths and setting them to music. Now, Wagner did that. Of course, what he turned to were different myths. German stories, Scandinavian legends. He didn't go back to the Greeks. But what he did do was take those stories, he set myths on the stage, he gave us gigantic heroes, gods, warriors, and gave an extraordinary vision of nobility, and the music matches it. the gigantic orchestras, the tremendous demands made on the singers. With Verdi, you have something else, something very different. With Verdi, you have the human scale, very much the human scale. Verdi turned for his material to popular plays. He wrote operas based on the plays of Victor Hugo, some Spanish dramas. He turned to Shakespeare. What Verdi was looking at was the life of the human heart. And Verdi never moves into what I would call the kind of gigantic vision of Wagner. It simply doesn't happen. Even in his biggest operas, and some of them are enormous in size and scope. Otello is a big opera. you can get a sense from the film. Of course, what you saw was a film of the opera, not the same thing as the opera stage. But you can imagine just the number of forces it would take to put something like that on the stage. You need about 8 principal singers. You need an enormous chorus. You still need a very large orchestra. Not to mention sets, costumes, props. It's a huge undertaking, and it's for that very reason that opera is enormously expensive. Some years ago, I'm sure this has gone up, but I think the figure was every night at the Metropolitan Opera in New York, when the curtain went up, if they had a full house, and taking the subsidies that they were given from the National Endowment, from this and that, and the money from Mrs. Pennypacker and all of that, every night the curtain went up, the opera company lost $40,000. And that was about 15, 20 years ago. I'm sure now it's probably at least doubled. So that the very fact of doing a single performance and putting the curtain up, they're losing money. They're losing money. There's some, and that's with top ticket price at the Met now at $120 a ticket. Okay? They are still losing that much money. Reason is it just takes an enormous number of, you're paying a lot of people to put one of these things on. It's not the same thing as no offense intended, a string quartet where you can get 4 people together. Okay? That's difficult enough to pay if you, but to have that number of forces, a 60, 70, or if we get into Wagner, 80-piece orchestra, just for starters. So there are practical problems with the opera, and Verdi's operas are large, but their subject is human nature. Their subject is human nature. And many of his most successful operas, some of the most popular, deal with recognizable human nature in a recognizable setting. Many of you have heard it's one of his early operas called La Traviata, which is the setting of the Camille story. It was an enormous fiasco when it was first premiered because it had a contemporary setting. At that time, the Italians liked to have at least the story set back in time somewhere. And La Traviata at the time was about a courtesan in contemporary Paris, and the audience was just horrified by it. But again, it went very much in terms of what Verdi was doing, and that was something that was lifelike, that which was recognizable, that which dealt with the human heart. And we certainly get that in his Otello. Let me place Otello in time for you. Verdi had a very successful career, born in 1813. He composed his first opera on a commission for La Scala when he was in his early 20s. I believe he was 22 years old. Opera was called Oberto. It had a modest success, not a great success, but enough of a success so that the opera company commissioned a second opera from him. What they asked for was a comedy. He began working on it, and then within the space of 6 months, his wife died and his 2 children died, all within the space of 6 months. He went to the opera company and asked to be released from the contract because, as he put it, quite understandably, he could not write a comic opera at that time. They demanded that he fulfill the contract. He wrote the comic opera, didn't write another comic opera until he was 80 years old, sometime later. Verdi had in his way a tragic vision, a dark vision. That came from a number of different sources. Clearly that unfortunate incident was one. He was also very much a political activist. Italy at the time dominated by Austria, there was an enormous popular movement trying to free northern Italy from the control of the Austrians. Verdi became intricately involved in that, and many of his early operas were taken as patriotic gestures, calling for freedom for Italy. So much of his early popularity and his early operas had to do with his association with that political movement. He was enormously popular throughout his career. He became popular throughout the world. Wagner stayed very much in Germany. Wagner remained a German composer, very well known, but he was loyal to Germany and eventually built his own opera house to do his works in. Verdi wrote operas for London, for the Paris Opera. The St. Petersburg Opera commissioned an opera for him, one of his greatest, called La Forza del Destino, The Force of Destiny. And of course, the most famous commission in all of artistic history is perhaps after Pope Julius getting Michelangelo to paint the ceiling of that little chapel, was when the Khedive of Egypt commissioned Verdi to write an opera to honor the opening of the Suez Canal. Well, Verdi milked him for a lot of money. And wrote up a brilliant contract. This was in 1871. So he would have been close. He was in his late 50s. He knew what he was up to. Got a magnificent contract where Egypt had the rights to the first performance of the opera. It's known as Aida, the most popular opera ever written. But all subsequent rights, every other premiere, everywhere in the world, the money would go to Verdi. So he wrote it for Egypt. Indeed, there is the triumphal march and the grand song, the grand chorus, Glory to Egypt, has become the Egyptian national anthem. It's a superb piece of music, and he made out like a bandit. Just made out like a bandit. And viewed that pretty much as the end of his career. He had done what he intended to do. He didn't intend to do a great deal more. So at about 60 years of age, he thought he had done his work. He had 20-some operas behind him. They were being done all over the world. The commissions were good. He had married a woman whose own reputation had been something like that of Violetta and Traviata. She had been a singer of questionable reputation. She and Verdi had lived together for a number of years. And then finally they married. They had regularized their relationship. And he became very domestic at that point. They never had children. But they were quite happily married. And it looked as if that was going to be about it. He wrote one other piece, and it was a requiem, the most theatrical, dramatic requiem ever written. It's a powerhouse of a piece. Not necessarily, not really appropriate for an ecclesial setting, but if you want the drama of what will go on with the soul after death, it's there. It's theatrical music. Gorgeous, gorgeous music, filled with one glorious melody after another. He wrote it in honor of his friend Manzoni, the Italian novelist who had died. But then that was going to be about it. In the 1880s, he noticed something happening in Italian music that made him very uneasy. The tradition was being lost. Wagner had become such an overwhelming force in the musical world that Verdi saw the young Italian composers beginning to mimic Wagner. They were taking on the characteristics of German music, German opera, and the whole vision, the Wagnerian vision, which can be infectious, which can be overwhelming, which can simply take control. And Wagner had made his way, if you will, into Italy and had won the hearts and the minds of the young Italian composers. Verdi was disturbed by this. He had great respect for Wagner, unlike Wagner, who dismissed Verdi out of hand, insulted him at every opportunity. he really was a piece of work, that. he really was something. Verdi, however, being a gentleman, a farmer and a gentleman, who appreciated great music, always spoke highly of Wagner. In fact, there's a famous little note written by Verdi when he learned of Wagner's death in 1883. Very simple. It's in his. He wrote it to a friend. He had learned of Wagner's death, and he wrote, Wagner e morte, triste, 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 sad, sad, sad. And then praised him effusively, but said, we in Italy have our own tradition. We honor the great German tradition in music. It's very important, but it's the German tradition. We in Italy have our own tradition, and the young Italian composers are turning their back on it. And what happened was he got the itch to write again. He wanted, if you will, to show those young whippersnappers that you could still write Italian music in the Italian style and have a very successful work. Well, fortunately at the same time, one of those young whippersnappers who had criticized Verdi some years before for not being sufficiently Wagnerian, a young man named Arrigo Boito, began working on a libretto based on Shakespeare's Otello and decided through the music publisher to let Verdi have a look at it. Well, Verdi loved Shakespeare above all other writers. He had only written one Shakespearean opera, and that was a Macbeth early in his career. He had for years wanted to write a King Lear. It never got written, although there's some sketches for it that survive. But when Boito came with bits of this libretto and tempted him with it, Verdi took the bait. Partially, I think, because he loved Shakespeare, but also because he wanted to show the Italian tradition in music continuing. Very interesting. The first thing he did before composing, because it had been over 10 years since he had written an opera, and he was now in his 70s. The first thing he did was to go back and make an intensive study of the music of Palestrina. Point being, if he was going to, as he claimed, show the roots of Italian music, he went back to the roots and began studying Palestrina. And did a complete study of Italian music from Palestrina up to his own works, so that he could be sure that Otello would be put in context, that it would indeed be part of that tradition. Now, interestingly enough, even so, he tipped his hat to Wagner. And it is a mark to me of the generosity of the spirit of the man, that even as he taught the young Italians a lesson, he tipped his hat and said, look, I know what the man did. I admire him too. And this is seen in that Otello is what we call through composed. Let me explain what this means. Throughout most of the history of opera, the musical setting and the drama is divided into units. And the units are basically this. I'm simplifying here enormously, but just giving you the basic. First you had what was called recitative. Recitative. R-E-C-I-T-A-T-I-V-E. Which was dialogue set to music that moved the plot along. The story moving forward. And then you would have an aria. A-R-I-A. In which the action would stop. And a single character would reflect, if you would, on his or her situation, what had happened in the action. And the aria itself was often divided into two parts, a cavatina, a lyrical slow section at the beginning, and a cabaletta, a faster section that followed. This was the structure for years. Of course, you could have duets, trios, quartets, the rest of it. And those could be used in various ways, sometimes to move the action, sometimes for reflection. But nevertheless, the opera was divided into set pieces. And if you go back, for example, to Mozart's Marriage of Figaro, you will find these pieces numbered. Okay? Number one, duet, Figaro-Susanna. Okay? Number two, recitative, dialogue back and forth. Number three, aria, Figaro. Okay? So the thing is, if you will, chopped into sections. This piece, that piece, some recitative, this piece. What Wagner had done was insist that this was an artificial design. And Beethoven himself in his Fidelio had used this. If you look at the score of Fidelio, we've got piece number one, piece number two, number three, number four, okay? Recitative, aria, trio, aria, okay? More recitative. What Wagner said was, no. It's a stupid way. It's a stupid way of setting an opera. What we're going to have, and he said, is not opera anymore with these artificial structures, but music drama, where the two work together, where the two are balanced. It's the reason he said, I'm as great as Beethoven, I'm as great as Shakespeare, I can put the two together. He wrote his own librettos. He composed his own music. And it was through composed. The music starts and goes on to the end of the act. You don't stop. There is no place in there where the audience can applaud. We take a little break, and now we go on to the next number. We don't have that. He will put little set pieces in there for a singer, but it is within context, and we move into it, and we move out of it, and it is all unified. Verdi does that in Otello. Otello, in that sense, is shaped like a Wagner opera. It is through composed. You do not have moments as such set aside. It was Verdi showing, yes, I can do that too, and if it enhances the drama, I will do it. And therefore he did it. So the piece is indeed through composed. Verdi was a stern taskmaster. Boito agreed to do the libretto for him, but Verdi was notorious with his librettists. We have the letters that went back and forth between Ghislanzoni, who wrote the libretto for Aida, and Verdi. They're absolutely incredible. For the opening moment, I need an 8-line section rhyming this way with this rhythm. And Ghislanzoni would try to do it, come up with something. No, this isn't good. I need this sound at this point in this line. Send it back. He'd redo it. No, now you've thrown the balance off. Now I need a different rhyme here. He'd redo it. Verdi would drive his librettists mad. But the reason was he heard in his head what he wanted and couldn't get the music down until it was just exactly what it needed to be. And he was a perfectionist. He was a perfectionist. Drove his librettists mad. So while Boito clearly did the libretto, there is no doubt the old man was breathing over his shoulder, driving him nuts. Okay? So that while we credit Boito with the libretto has Verdi's fingerprints all over it. He made certain basic decisions, and Boito was there. Boito was a clever dramatist. He was also a musician. He has two or three operas of his own that are still occasionally performed. The most famous being one called Mephistopheles. But by this time, a setting of the Faust story, by this time he'd pretty much given up music and wrote the last two librettos for the last two operas of the grand master of 19th century Italian music, following Otello. I'll throw this in here just because it's a nice story and I like it. They finished Otello. It was an enormous success, 1883. Enormous success. Curiously, 1887. Wagner dies 1883, Otello 1887, and then Verdi's last opera is premiered in 1890, when he is in his late 70s, and it was a setting of Falstaff. Boito did a libretto of The Merry Wives of Windsor. It's the only case in the history of art where someone bettered Shakespeare. The Merry Wives of Windsor is a potboiler that supposedly Shakespeare tossed off in about 6 weeks, maybe less. Some say a week and a half, 2 weeks, because Queen Elizabeth gave an order she wanted to see Falstaff in love. So he tossed this thing off. We know that because it has more prose than any other Shakespeare play. It's sort of creaky in some places. It's a great stage vehicle. Boito decided that Verdi needed to write an opera on Merry Wives. Verdi said, no way, I won't do it. I'm too old. I'm done. Otello was it. That's the end of it. And then Boito said, I've got a Falstaff libretto, I've got another Shakespeare play, Falstaff, and Verdi said, no, shut up, I don't want to see you, I won't talk to you, go away, I'm old, I just want to die now. One night they were at a party. They were at a party, and this exchange had been going on for some months with Boito tempting Verdi. One more, you're not that old, you can write one more. And they were at a party and it had some wine, as is occasionally the case in Italy. And they were doing toasts around the table. And Boito filled his glass with wine and saw to it that Verdi's glass on the other end of the table had also been filled. And then Boito stood up and offered a toast to the fat knight. Nobody else at the table had any idea what Buido was talking about, but it was one of those moments. It was a challenge. It was a challenge. And Buido lifted his glass, and Verdi apparently gave him a nasty look. He realized he'd been cornered. This was the moment he had to decide. And the old man picked up his glass and stood up and toasted back to Buido and said, "Yes, yes, to the fat knight." And Buido was delighted and went right to work on the libretto. And at that moment, Falstaff was born. Otello is a great opera, but treat yourself sometime. It's interesting. It was Verdi's second comic opera, written in his late 70s. I mentioned the first one written in his early 20s. And it took that long before he felt he could sit down again and attempt to show the world in a comic light. And it is a masterpiece. It is a masterpiece. Now, in the brief time I have remaining in this lecture, I'll get into specifics in the next hour at 11. What I'd like to do is just talk about the overall shape of this libretto. That is, what it was that Verdi set. Those of you that saw the film last night, and I have to say there are some cuts in that film. Zeffirelli reduces the score a bit. You lose a few things along the way. So you saw most of the opera, but not the full thing. And you also saw a great film director who's turning it into a film. There are things happening on the film that you couldn't do on stage. There are practical stage limitations. I missed the viewing last night. It's been a couple years since I've seen the Zeffirelli film. I remember it fondly. I love Zeffirelli very much. It's spectacular to look at. One reason for viewing Zeffirelli films is he has a painter's eye, and almost every frame is designed, constructed, and gorgeous to look at. That's true of almost all of his films. Those of you that don't know the Zeffirelli Life of Christ, it's an 8-hour film that is a beautiful piece of work. And well worth viewing. There are things on that screen that you couldn't do in the opera house. Specifically, the duet, the big duet at the end of Act One. We're in Cyprus, and Desdemona makes her first appearance, and Otello and Desdemona sing a standard Italian love duet, in which, for the first time, we see the two characters together, and they give expression to their love. And in that, we get some lines that take us back to Act 1, Scene 3 of the Shakespeare, but what Zeffirelli is able to do on the film is show a little bit of the courtship. Couldn't do it on stage. On stage, the two would simply stand there on the battlements under the night sky and sing. So the film allows for certain possibilities that you would not ordinarily get on the stage. The stage is limiting in some ways. Nevertheless, you get the overall structure of the work. Now, it is indeed the case that many claim that Boito's work is superior to Shakespeare, okay? Here it is. You read this over and over and over again. And I'm pulling out the libretto here, and sure enough, here it is. It's talking about Boito, the reshaped play that he offered the maestro was truly a conception of tragedy for the music theater stage, rather than anything recognizable as a conventional libretto. Gone are the traditional formulae, not a rondo or cabaletta in sight. That's what I meant. It was a piece, even in the libretto, that just keeps moving forward, not set in little sections. Gone the display pieces for star singers who hold up the action for the sake of vocal appreciation. Let's stop everything now, and I'm going to show you what I can do with my voice, okay? Let's have some fireworks. I'm going to show off. No time for that. Boito wanted the piece to remain dramatic, not operatic in that sense, where we suddenly have a flamboyant singer just showing off. And in place of all this, Boito constructed a drama so taut and economic that it distills the very essence of Shakespeare's and has even achieved the ultimate accolade of being considered, in some respects, an improvement on the original. Hogwash. But let me tell you where this misconception comes from. The misconception comes from the fact that we have two totally different works that share a story. We are using the same storyline, but the works are completely different. And the reason so many modern critics view Boito's work as superior is because Boito's work and the opera that Verdi created from it is a thoroughly romantic 19th century piece of art. And as a result, closer to us and the way we respond to art than what Shakespeare had done 300 years earlier. Shakespeare's play is completely different. What do I mean by that? Let me give you some specific examples in terms of structure, the way this thing has been put together. And we have to start, of course, with the most obvious thing that Boito does, that he has been praised to the skies for doing, and that is discarding Act One. He comes to write the libretto and takes an axe and chops off Act One of the play and dispenses with it. So that the opera begins on the island of Cyprus, in the storm, at the moments the ships are arriving from Venice. Now, there is a good, solid operatic reason for doing this. It means the curtain can go up, and please notice, and this is fairly unusual, there's no overture. There's no overture to this opera. Usually in operas you have an overture. Music that will set the mood, prepare the audience, curtain goes up, then we're into the, not here. What Verdi wants is that effect of blasting the audience from the start so that the curtain goes up and boom, we're in the storm. The storm hits us immediately. It's a great dramatic opening. What have we lost? Well, given the vision I tried to present of Othello, what we have lost is the entire structure of ideas behind the play. Number one, patriarchy. That vision of Venice as an ordered, authoritarian society out of which the story grows and which the story has got to constantly reflect back on. We have lost the sense of patriarchy. Two, we have lost that sense of civilization, civilized order. We are in Cyprus from the beginning, and instantly we are thrown into chaos. In Act One of Shakespeare's play, I tried to point out how we begin and see discord and trouble beginning and building very slowly as the first act goes along until then it explodes once we get to Cyprus. We don't have that. There is not that context. We begin in Cyprus on the island away from civilized order. That's where we start. And therefore, once the ships have arrived, the very first thing that happens is Iago gets Cassio drunk. We have the bonfires, we have the celebration, we have the party because of the arrival of the fleet, the defeat of the Turks, and instantly Iago is beginning his plan, he's getting Cassio drunk, and we have that disorder coming instantly, almost at once. Please notice, Iago begins his plot against Othello and against Cassio before we ever even meet Desdemona. The evil is present, the evil is operating, and we have not yet seen the target. And this can happen, it works musically. I'm not going to play this morning the drinking song, it's magnificent. I was once lucky enough to study opera history with a very great opera composer who teaches at the University of Minnesota named Dominic Argento. He gave one of the great lectures I've ever heard where he took a series of Verdi drinking songs from early in Verdi's career through Traviata, through the middle period works, and ended with the drinking song in Othello and showed the development of Verdi's musical imagination. Just, oh man, you know, the moments you treasure that come too rarely, I'm afraid. But this is an extremely complex drinking song. It is not just let's raise a cup and let's get drunk. Dramatically, it's brilliant in that Iago is tempting Cassio. It is intricately involved with the setting of the plot, and musically it is wonderful because as you listen to the music, you hear Iago in control and you hear Cassio getting drunk. The poor singer and his vocal line, the vocal line of Cassio becomes drunk as he sings. It's great musical writing. But all of this is going on before we've even met Desdemona. We don't know who she is, okay? Unless we've read the Shakespeare. So that the plot is underway before we have a sense of the victim. the plot is underway before we really have a sense of what is going on here, or who is this guy doing this, and why is he doing it, and what's going on. But what we get is, notice, the excitement and the thrill of the opening. Let me distill it this way. Let me bring it down to this. Shakespeare begins his play by setting a series of themes and ideas. In that way, he is a poet, as T.S. Eliot was a poet some centuries after Shakespeare. As Lieutenant Childs pointed out yesterday, Burnt Norton begins with Eliot setting out his major themes. Now, Shakespeare may have been writing a drama, but what he does in Act One of Othello is sets out his major themes. These are the ideas I'm going to explore. How do we know we're in the 19th century? We're in the 19th century, and we are now in the age of Romanticism because, to quote Goethe, Gefühl ist alles. Feeling is everything. I'm not going to set an idea. I'm not going to start out by giving themes, a couple of musical themes. What I'm going to do is have a huge emotional impact on the audience. Storm, kaboom! In comes our hero. We'll look at that moment in a little bit. Othello walks in, sings one line, and exits. The hero has arrived. There's our hero. Okay, now here's our villain. There's Iago going, ooh, I'm going to get Cassio drunk. And so we have a big drink. Everything that's going on is seeking toward an emotional response from an audience. If there is intellect at work in the opera, and there is, it is in the construction of the music, which is brilliant. And it means that a musician can hear the brilliant ideas, musical ideas in Verdi, but those ideas are being used to pack a wallop with the audience so that the audience is going to be moved one way or another. Ooh, there's a storm, I'm scared. Ooh, there's the hero. Oh, I feel great. Oh, there's the villain. Ooh, makes me feel scared. Oh, now at the end of Act One, in comes the beautiful heroine, in comes the hero, and we sing. We cannot call it a traditional standard love duet, although it is. It's very well integrated into the design of the first act. We meet her, they go back, they talk about how they met, how they got together, they sing of their love, it's under the starry night sky, and we're going, oh. I ask you to go back to the Shakespeare play. We're not allowed to do that in Shakespeare. The first time we see Othello is not grand hero exploding out of the storm, having survived and overcome the Turks. The first time we see Othello, he's simply walking through the streets of Venice, talking to Iago. It is simple. It's human. It is not heroic. He rises to heroism as he describes his past, but then he's not talking to Desdemona. He's talking about the wooing of Desdemona, and he's wooing the senators to allow him to continue to do his work. And when Desdemona comes in, we get the two of them not in a happy little love scene, but she is trying to make a point to her father, make a point to the Senate. Othello is trying to make a point to the Senate, trying to see to it that he can still go off and fight the Turks. We have this intricate web net that will be played on by Iago of different people responding to other characters. Perfect example. Notice what happens to Rodrigo in the opera. He's there, we need him, but he vanishes. He is hardly a character at all. And by the end, you don't miss him. I ask you to compare that with the moment of the actor who played Rodrigo in the Olivier film. That extraordinary moment when you see a character coming to recognition. And once again, Shakespeare's design is such, given what he has done, a seemingly supporting or minor character can suddenly rise up and have a moment of genuine recognition. Not possible here, because Rodrigo is submerged in this wash of emotion. Okay? Now, something else happens. I'll just do this quickly, and then I'll pick up here at 11. One last thing. Looking at the jettisoning of Act One again. In the film, during the love duet, end of Act One, They are singing about the wooing, and it was very happy. And we see them, and then we see a quick glimpse of the father who gives his daughter to the warrior. Okay? Now, obviously, given the point I made, we're in a different world, a very different world. But beyond that, we now have different characters. The Desdemona of the opera is not the Desdemona of the play. The Desdemona of the play, we learn, is the one who first began hanging around Othello when he was telling the stories of his bravery in battle. She was the one who said, "Oh, I wish you'd tell me some of those stories sometime." She is the one who said, "If you have a friend who wanted to woo me, get him to tell me those stories, and that would win my heart." Wink, wink. She is the one, clearly, who has agreed to elope without telling her father, that begins that sense of a violation of the patriarchy, that leads us to the point where Brabantio will issue the warning to Othello, "Look to her more if thou hast eyes to see. She has deceived her father, and may thee..." All that's gone. Desdemona in the opera is not the real woman of the play. In the play, Desdemona is complicitous in the coming fall. There's no getting around it. Desdemona is a daughter of Eve in the play. She is a seductress. She is a trickster. A very lovely one. I don't want to make this sound too negative. We like her. She's beautiful. But she gets what she wants. And as a result, we have a real woman. Okay? It is a complex part. Let me do it this way. This is quite nice. A seminarian who shall remain nameless, before we watched the opera film, having seen the first act of the Othello, said, "I don't care for that Desdemona." And then began rhapsodizing about Katia Ricciarelli, who sings Desdemona in the movie. She is gorgeous. She's absolutely gorgeous. And there is a reason for that. Maggie Smith is playing a real woman in the play. Ricciarelli is an angel, an icon. When we first meet her, she is already in Cyprus. She comes out at the end of the first act. She sings of her love. She has done nothing. There is no way in which anything that happens in the opera can be put at her doorstep. She has made no decision other than falling in love with the man who falls in love with her in return. It is a good, wonderful, open, honest, heartwarming, give a big sigh, aren't they a lovely young couple, love. It is the stuff of romanticism. Shakespeare's is not. Shakespeare's is love in the real world. I want this guy, I'm going to get him. My dad won't let me have him. Well, okay, have to find a way to get around dad then. Okay, I got him. Ooh, dad's mad. Oh, hubby's going off to war. Excuse me, Mr. Senator, let me go off to war with my hubby now, okay? The operatic character is an angel, is an angel. And the music she sings is angelic. And when she is destroyed, it tears our heart out. It is deeply moving. Desdemona in the play is a real woman living in a real world who has made choices based on free will. And when she is killed, having lived through a real story with connections to real life, we feel pity and fear. At the end of the opera, we don't feel that fear. We feel doubled, tripled pity. Okay? It is a great moment. The point I am making is, it is a different character. When we come back, I'll talk about the different Iago.